Welcome back to the three natures, even though we've been in them, all three of them, all week, we might have forgotten. Since all phenomena have these three natures, we are phenomena, so we have these three natures, or we are in these three natures. We are never apart from imaginations of what's happening, dependently arising appearances of what's happening, and the perfect freedom from imaginations and even from appearances. All of these are working together and happening all the time. We don't have to create any of them. But our work as practitioners is to distinguish them, to see the difference between these three natures, which usually seems to be a big murky mess, and thus we get caught up in all kinds of trouble. I just came across this description of mind only, not specifically about the three natures, but it's what this three natures points to, how we create a world out of mind. And this is maybe sounds very familiar, but for me this struck me as, oh, this is a really clear, concise way of speaking. So see what you think. This is Kenpo Sultram Gyatso. He says, we ordinarily think the outer objects we perceive, like mountains, rivers, and stars, exist before we perceive them. Don't we? And we've talked about this, and I think we have problems. And this kind of thing comes up, especially like mountains, rivers, and stars. The more distant and big and ancient they are, the more we have problems with this kind of teaching. We may even think they have existed for millions of years before we encountered them, and therefore they truly exist outside of our perception of them. But that way of thinking is confused. For how could a perceived object exist independently of mind's perception of it? I think what makes this helpful here is we're talking about perceived objects. You might not even notice that he said that. We think of outer objects we perceive, like mountains, rivers, and stars. We think those perceptions exist before we perceive them. So already that sounds like, well, of course not, right? How could a perceived object exist independently of a mind's perception of it? What characteristics would it have? Those characteristics could not be known by the mind because they would have to exist independent of and separate from the mind. Right? If the perceived mountain had some characteristic apart from the mind, that wouldn't make sense because we're just talking about the perceived mountain. It completely depends on the perceiver. Now there's another discussion of like, is there a mountain? What about the mountain before our perception of it? But in a way, we're not even really going. We don't need to go there. Mind-only tradition says, well, if there is such a mountain before we perceive it, we don't need to worry about that. Because the only one we're ever going to relate to is the one we perceive. Unknowable characteristics could be posited, but never verified or perceived. In other words, if there were characteristics of a mountain, you know, before our perception of it, or, you know, an unperceived mountain, we could posit those characteristics, like it's really solid, even whether we perceive it or not, but we can never verify or perceive those characteristics. Right. As soon as we, perceive or verify them, then they're dependent on our perception. That is why the only characteristics an object can possibly have are those that the mind can possibly know. Therefore, perceived objects and their characteristics are only mind. Does that make sense? I mean, this is like pretty straightforward. It's what we've already been talking about, but we're just emphasizing perceived objects and their characteristics are only mind. Yes?
It does make a lot of sense, but it raises another curious thing for me to ask a question about, and that is the emphasis on the perception phenomena as a perceived object. And given the third characteristic of phenomena, which is basically imperceivable in itself, this whole business about is there a mountain or am I making it up, can we say that this third characteristic of thoroughly established
or perfect
is
reality?
We can impute to that it is just the basis of perceptions. We can't actually say what it is that's producing a mountain in our mind, in our imputation.
I mean, usually we speak of the other dependent nature as like the basis of perceptions and the perceptions themselves. Alaya, vijnana, the storehouse consciousness, is also another psychological name for the other dependent character, and that's also called the basis of perceptions.
I thought the Alaya was the
thoroughly
established.
No.
No, it's not.
No, Alaya is more like we could almost equate with the other dependent. It's the appearance of everything that appears dependent upon conditions emerging from this alaya. Now we do have, and we'll get into in the next 2 weeks following this relationship between the storehouse consciousness, alaya, and Tathagatagarbha or Buddha nature. And Buddha nature or Tathagatagarbha can be equated with the thoroughly established or perfect nature. Non-dual awareness of Buddha nature. But usually when we're talking about alaya traditionally, that's more connected with the other dependent nature.
Okay, so this resolves the confusion I had about who I sent you.
Furthermore, all those characteristics of an object that consciousness perceives exist only at the moment of and together with perception of them. So it's like we open our eyes and see the Buddha on the altar. It's like we think that, in our confused way, we think that the Buddha that we're seeing was there before we see it. But it's the moment of the perceiver and the perceived meeting in one moment. It's a simultaneous thing. All those characteristics of an object that consciousness perceives exist only at the moment of and together with the perception of them. For if a perceived object existed before its perceiving consciousness, what would be perceiving it? Again, this is kind of just Buddhist logic, right? We're talking about the perceived object. If a perceived object existed before the perception of it, how could it be a perceived object, right? We can't call it a perceived object unless it's perceived by a perceiver, right? And you might say, well, that's just kind of silly, so simple, it's not even worth saying. But this is the realm of kind of logical reasoning to start breaking down our illogical, normal way of seeing things. We might even think, without examining for a moment, that a perceived object could be there before we perceive it. But that's ridiculous, right? Does that make sense? Can you follow? We're talking about perceived objects, not just objects in general, because then we could maybe argue some other case. But a perceived object means it's perceived, right? That's what it is. It's perceived. So you can't have a perceived object before there's a perceiver of it.
Object in our perception?
Yeah, object in our perception.
Mm-hmm. It takes away the idea of looking at something differently.
Okay, object in our perception. And so it depends on the perceiver, and it's not like one comes before the other. They simultaneously arise. A perceived object and a perceiving consciousness arise together. Right? This is worth contemplating this, and I think you can see that you don't have to take up any magical beliefs here. This is just pure, straightforward logic. But the interesting thing is, we don't usually think this way. So, all those characteristics of an object that consciousness perceives exist only at the moment of and together with the perception of them. For if a perceived object existed before its perceiving consciousness, what would be perceiving it? What would know it? It would be a perceived object without a perceiving subject, which would be illogical. Similarly, the perceiving subject cannot exist before the object it perceives. Because if it did, it would be a perceiver without an object of perception. So, by definition, a perceiving consciousness, if it's a perceiving consciousness, it has to perceive something, or else it's not a perceiving consciousness. So you don't have a perceiving consciousness before there's waiting to perceive some object. It doesn't become a perceiving consciousness until it perceives an object. That's what makes it a perceiving consciousness. So this is, we're talking about the dependent arising together of the perceived object and the perceiving consciousness. Neither one exists before the other. Which again, before we examine, we might think either the mind exists and then objects come forward from that, or we think objects exist and then the mind comes forward to meet them. But we're approaching the realm of non-duality here, where the perceiver and the perceived arise together. They depend on each other. It's one event. That's the non-duality. It's one event. You can't separate them. That would be dualistic to say, I can exist without the world, or the world can exist without me. That's our usual belief in duality.
Shouldn't we make that same distinction when discussing the ground and the objective support from which imagined reality arises? Because that seems to suggest that one comes before the other.
Ah, good question. So, a ground before the projected entities. I think what we could say is that we're talking about the ground of the storehouse consciousness includes all subjects and objects. It's not a subject, and it's not like Alaya is like the perceiving subject. It's inconceivable. The storehouse consciousness, it includes all subjects and consciousnesses. And also one of the classical stories is every moment of experience arises with these two parts of subject and object. It's sometimes even said there's these seeds of experience that are planted in Alaya, and the seeds give rise to experiences, and they technically speaking, it's usually said that there's one seed gives rise to a perceiver and a perceived. So it's not which is a nice way of, and these are just metaphors really, but it's a nice way of talking, because if you say there's one seed for a perceiving consciousness, say a seed for a visual consciousness and then a seed for a color, you might think, well, one would, they might go pop, pop, they might sprout a little bit differently. So I think it's a nice description of this storehouse is that there's one seed has two sprouts coming off it, you could say. One seed simultaneously gives rise to an eye consciousness and a color. And then so it's one experience, it's still a non-dual experience, but there's the appearance of these two separate things. The mere appearance is still just a dependently co-arisen, dependent nature. But then immediately we say, that's not one thing. that's me and the object out there, and that's the imaginary nature that reifies that perceiver and perceived appearance. Furthermore, therefore perceived objects and their characteristics are only mind.
That one. Maybe 2 lines back.
Before that. The only characteristics an object can possibly have are those that the mind can possibly know. Therefore perceived objects and their characteristics are only mind. And then there's the part about the simultaneous. Furthermore, all those characteristics of an object that consciousness perceives exist only at the moment of and together with perception of them. Yeah. Let me go on a little bit more here. We'll keep talking about this. This is just one version of this. Since the perceived object and the perceiving subject must exist together with each other in this simultaneous way, one does not exist outside or independent of the other. Object and subject are both merely mind. Okay. What we call objects that the mind perceives are also mind in this way. Okay. For example, when we see a rock mountain in a dream, dreams are a classic metaphor in mind only. When we see this rock mountain in a dream, we may assume that it existed there long before we perceived it, but it didn't, right? In the dream mountain, we vividly see in the dream, and the dream, we think, it's like we don't even have to think, we just assume in the dream that the mountain existed before we perceived it, but obviously in the dream, we're just creating it in the moment. And it's saying that waking life is pretty much the same as a dream in this way. The appearance of the perceived rock mountain and the perceiving consciousness are precisely simultaneous in the dream. The same is true during the day, and therefore external objects are only mind. Yes. Who said that?
A friend of mine. Who's stayed for a long time. He says it's dreaming out loud.
Waking life. Yeah. It's like dreaming out loud. Yeah. Yeah. It's when trying to contemplate, especially when our skeptical mind comes in and thinks, well, how could it be possible that we could, that the mind could be creating, that the perceiving mind is arising simultaneously with the perceived world, or you could even say how the mind can be creating this virtual mind world. It's too far out. It's like science fiction. But then they say, remember how we dream. That doesn't seem like science fiction, right? The mind can vividly create a whole three-dimensional world every night. That's not so far out. But then we make this big distinction between dreaming life and waking life. And mind only says there is some distinction, but not as much as we think. It's the same process, basically. It's just that the way Alaya creates sensory objects in the so-called real world is it's maybe more complex. And more shared, we have a more shared thing. We don't usually share the same dreams. So it's more amazing, and it's therefore harder to grok. So, yeah.
So, can we say, well, I assume we can say that what we speak of as a Alaya that contains our karmic tendencies has, it's kind of like a basis for personhood in a way.
Yeah.
And that we all have these things, personal things, Elias, but there's maybe an Elia of Elias, all possible persons, all possible aggregates. And that what makes a dream different from, say, waking reality is that when we're having a conversation, our karmas are actually intersecting. It's like a Venn diagram.
Mm-hmm.
And we wind up having things in common. Whereas in a dream, it's just our own Elia working.
Yeah, I think that's the difference. That's the amazing thing about waking life is that our Elias are overlapping in this inconceivable way. And again, the image for me that's been coming up recently is about this shared thing, which I may have mentioned in this class, is like, again, excuse my non-scientific background here, but a hologram, like the kind you see in Disney World, like the 3D kind of hologram, it's a 3D projected image, and my understanding is that it's projected from light sources in different places. Is that right from the scientific background? I think there's different, even a movie projector coming from different directions, and together they make a three-dimensional image in the middle that looks real.
Yes.
And so in that way, we're like these different projectors, and this image in the middle is like this world that we're agreeing on. It's an illusory world that appears to be one world, but it's only the kind of collectively shared version of this world is co-projected from all these different angles, right?
Well, there's another interesting part of holograms, part of holography, which you're talking about. The nature of a hologram is that it contains all the information that could describe the whole. So you can take any part of a hologram, and when you project the light through it in a certain way, the way they created it, you'll get the whole image. So, in a sense, what I hear being said here is that we are all holograms of the basis, of the ground, in a sense. And our individual karmic tendency is one expression of the whole. And that we can actually transform these by our common experience with each other, first of all. But secondly, we can also see that if we contain all the information necessary to describe the whole, then our personal practice is actually transforming the whole. Anything that we do in ourselves to move towards whatever practice moves us towards is actually a transformation of the whole. So there is a merging of difference in unity. We see ourselves that way. And if we see our conversation even as expressions of the basis in forming a hologram that is the two of us talking.
Yeah, so that's an even further addition to this metaphor of the hologram, that each part containing the whole.
Yeah.
And this is another a quote from Carl Brunholzl that I thought was kind of nice about the three natures. Now, remember, we're going back to the three. Let's see, Nadine, do you have one of these copies? The three natures being that the other dependent appearances, and then the reified belief that these appearances are separate from the mind, and then called the imagined nature, and then the thoroughly established or perfect nature that's free of that illusion. So his quote is, something appears but doesn't exist in the way it appears. So you could say, that something is the other dependent nature. Other dependent appearances appear, but doesn't exist in the way it appears. You follow that? Something appears. This room appears, but it doesn't exist truly in the way it appears. Something exists, but it doesn't appear in the way it exists. And the something that exists is the perfect nature. And a way we can say it exists, it's not a thing that exists exactly, but it's truth, it's like reality. But it doesn't appear the way it exists. In suchness, there are no appearances, actually. It's completely free from all appearances. So I thought that's a neat little kind of two-part thing. Something appears, but it doesn't exist in the way that it appears. Something exists, but it doesn't appear in the way that it exists. Can you follow that?
Yes.
That's about the three natures.
So could we talk about this all night?
Yes, yeah, probably will.
Why would we allow other alliances, other commingling alliances, you know, my alliance and your alliance, and we don't allow mountains? We don't allow other objects.
What do you mean allow?
Well,
to
we don't allow mountains to exist before we perceive them.
Oh, and you're saying, but alayas we allow to exist before we perceive them? This is where I think it gets kind of tricky to talk about, because the way we allow other alayas is the same way, really. It's not like there really are these other alayas, because alaya is like this, it's this appearance too. Alayas don't really exist either. That's part of the thing that in the thoroughly established, or the transformation of the basis, it's the dissolving of the illusion of alaya. So it's not that different from a mountain. You could say it is a little step, because the mountains in a way come out of alaya. The mountains are projections from alaya, so the mountains are a little bit more illusory, maybe, that they're the basis of the mountains, of the perceived mountains, is the alaya. But in a way, we could say, your alaya doesn't exist prior to my alaya meeting it. It's that, how we explain that, I think we can't quite exactly. But the only way that our alayas are overlapping is simultaneous. It's always simultaneous in the moment, right? So, it's not like, we can imagine conveniently that there's these other alayas after our alaya goes, but I think that starts to break down the mind-only vision. I think we have to say that at the moment our alaya is born, it's inconceivably, interpenetrating all other alayas that are born at the same moment with it. But that's true of each of us. So it doesn't fall into solipsism. But the way that that works is like we can't get a handle on it. But things like quantum physics and stuff start to play with how this kind of completely different type of reality may be possible. But our usual sense of time and space and sequence and things like this can't get a hold of it. So we have to. Maybe just briefly, because we want to keep going on.
We can say a mountain has karma. We can say a mountain actually converses. The climbers who get caught in avalanches know this. It affects the weather. In a sense, we can say a mountain has all the attributes that we have.
And it doesn't exist as an object of perception except for a sentient being's perception of it.
So we don't have to.
Nothing is excluded in this model. Now we're at verse 6 on page 159, and near the bottom of page 1 on this handout, we got up to the two truths here. There's a conventional truth, samvritti satya, and an ultimate truth, paramartha satya, and a third that denies causation. Projections refer to conventional truth, their cessation is the realm of sages. So this is two truths is important teaching in Buddhism. And here's a little excerpt about it here. And I think it's a nice way to tie it into the three natures. Or what, you know, what Red Pine's translating as the three modes of reality, you could call like three truths in a way. You can line them up here. So the conventional truth, we could call the mere appearances of the other dependent nature. Dependently arising appearances is what we call the conventional truth. Ultimate truth is suchness, free of even all of even appearances. In ultimate truth, there's no arising and ceasing. There's no dependent arising and no dependent ceasing, and there's no appearances. In ultimate truth, it's free from all projections. So when we're talking about these three natures, and this is classically the way it's talked about, the other dependent nature is the conventional truth in this mind of liberty. The thoroughly established or perfect nature is the ultimate truth. And then there's a third, though, here. Truth? Maybe, at least a third, something here, that denies causation. And I think it's Red Pine's footnote says, these other schools of philosophy believe that there's like an uncaused creator, maybe, that's the origin of the world, but that creator was not caused, doesn't arise by conditions, or any form of denying causation, I think would be the third. So I thought one way to look at this is the imagined nature. The imagined, like, in the imagined nature, so like this recorder, remember the recorder has three natures, right? It has the other dependent appearance arising from the storehouse consciousness of color and shape, and then the appearance gets linked to a name, recorder, and then when those get fused together, immediately it's like, now we really think it is a recorder. It's become now imagined or imputed as an actual recorder, and particularly separate from the mind. It really exists before the mind. It exists when I'm not looking at it. We have this projection or imagination. And you could say that's the uncaused recorder, right? Now, if we started thinking, we could look at various forms of, well, if we start thinking about it, we could see, well, it is caused by various things, maybe. But when we just see it, it doesn't seem to be like dependent, particularly, it doesn't seem to be dependent on our perception of it. It seems to exist in and of itself, uncaused. That's our like immediate take on it. At least that's my experience. I first look at it, I don't see how it's kind of like arising and ceasing in this interdependent way. Boom, I just see this independently existing, uncaused recorder before I think about it. And we could say that's this third truth here, is the uncaused imaginary nature. Can you see how, like, this is a kind of a three truths model, right? Conventional truth, and by the way, samvritti in conventional means the concealer truth. It's like a veil over the reality of the ultimate truth. And that veil is these mere appearances, these kind of dreamlike appearances that we call the world are veiling, they're covering the ultimate truth of unprojected light. So again, there's conventional truth and ultimate truth, and a third that denies causation. I would call that the imaginary nature. No, I'm saying this is like pure delusion. Dharmakaya is like the ultimate, actually. This would be like, this denied causation is like, this really exists. This thing really exists apart from causation. That's purely imaginary, imputed, total delusion, thorough fantasy. This is parikalpita, right? That's this third truth. It's not really true at all, right? It's totally delusion, but we could call it this third truth, that denies causation. The imputational. Projections refer to conventional truth. And again, we're saying before the projected is the imagined nature, but projections, the projecting capacity of mind, is the conventional truth. And their cessation, the cessation of projections, is the realm of sages, or the ultimate truth. There's a whole mind only two and three truths model here. Like someone who contemplates, who perceives a multitude in one where no multitude exists, this is what projections resemble. So now we're going back into talking about these terms some more. Projections are like when we perceive a room with platforms and people and walls and ceilings and all these different parts where there's really just one appearing inconceivable appearance. When we imagine this multiplicity of things, that's a projection. There aren't really multiple things in reality. But when we perceive a multitude in oneness, where no multitude exists, that's what projections do. Or that's what the other dependent nature does. It appears as a multiplicity of phenomena. And then we can grasp it and actually make it into a really solidly truly existing separate things. But it even appears as a multiplicity. So both the other dependent nature and the imagined nature are the realm of multiplicity. Like someone with cataracts who imagines different forms, which neither are nor aren't the cataracts, dependent reality is thus mistaken. So this is another classic Indian metaphors. Cataracts in the eyes that distort your vision. And I think in the Sāṭīṇāmocana Sutra, it uses this example too, and it talks about the cataracts themselves, or the eye disease, is like the other dependent. We're seeing these appearances of like color and stuff on the eye, but then when we think that the thing we see with the cataracts is like a flower falling in the sky, for example, the flower in the sky is imagined. It's purely imagined. It doesn't exist at all. But the cataracts are like the other dependent nature. There is an appearance of a color, but it's actually on the surface of the eye. The mere appearance is just an appearance. But then when we imagine that what we see through the cataract is actually a falling flower in the sky, that's the completely imagined imputational nature.
So a mirage,
the effect of the in the desert of the, however that works, the heat waves on the desert creating an illusion of water, the appearance of the heat waves is the other dependent, but the actual water in the desert is imagined. Can you follow that? These are really good metaphors for distinguishing the three natures. And then the absence of the water, the fact that it's just sand, there's no water there at all, that's the perfect truth. The actual reality is that there is no water. And or sand. I mean, the metaphors start to break down there. Yeah, or sand. Or like the snake and the rope, right? Because the snake is the imagined. It's really not a snake. The rope is just a mere appearance of a rope. That's the other dependent. And then the true, perfect nature is that there is no snake. It's more like, not so much like the true rope, but it's more like the absence of the snake, or the absence of the pond in the desert, or the absence of an actual recorder and an actual person and an actual altar and zendo. in suchness there aren't these things. Talk more about the absence.
Can you use that mirage metaphor with stars and wisdom, or with Carl?
About the something exists and. Yeah, let's see. Something appears but doesn't exist in the way that it appears. Yeah, that fit. That's a nice way.
So the water appears.
Yep, but it doesn't exist in the way it appears. Yeah. Something exists, this is, which is the absence of the water, but the absence of the water doesn't appear in the way that it exists. In other words, we can't. The suchness doesn't appear, unfortunately, to us. Or emptiness doesn't appear. Ah, there it is, emptiness, cool. It's like, it really does exist. Not as a thing, but it's the true, it's the truest reality of all things. And that way it exists. Ultimately exists as truth, but it doesn't appear. And it doesn't exist as some substantial thing, right? It exists as an as not a thing. It exists, in other words, the absence. The absence of the water in the desert, that absence really does exist. It's a nice way of talking about, a way of approaching this thing of how emptiness is like permanent and truly existent. It's like, what? But can you see how, like, the absence of the water, or the absence of the snake in the rope, really exists? The lack of snake, we can't deny that lack of snake. And it's permanent, too, right? It's like, the snake has never been in the rope, and never will be in the rope. And the water never will be on the desert. And never was in the desert. In that way, it's emptiness is permanent. And that's why it's sometimes in these mind-only traditions called the thoroughly established nature, which is kind of this funny thing. The way that the snake is never in the rope, that way that it never exists there, is thoroughly established. You can never deny the absence of the snake in the rope.
Can we speak of emptiness as
a
limit of consciousness?
Limit of consciousness. Consciousness, particularly in the mind-only version of emptiness or suchness, it's, I'd say it's not realized by consciousness. Consciousness is by nature dualistic. Consciousness is an other-dependent appearance, but wisdom that is not consciousness, non-dual wisdom, can realize suchness or emptiness. It can be realized, but just not by our ordinary dualistic consciousness. And that's this whole story in mind only of the dualistic consciousness is at the moment of Buddhahood, let's say, are transformed or actually revealed, made better, revealed to be not consciousness. The consciousness is maybe the most subtle delusion, and the revelation at Buddhahood is that consciousness is not consciousness. It's actually, it's not nothing though. It's perfect non-dual awareness called Buddhahood and Buddha nature, that we all is our birthright, that we all have, are right now, is actually this non-dual Buddha wisdom right now, but it's just obscured, you could say, by consciousness, by the illusion of dualistic consciousness, that there's like me, there's a mental consciousness here, perceiving a recorder over here. That's that, not only the illusion of the recorder, but the very consciousness that's perceiving it is also very, very subtle illusion, according to this story, that's not exactly transformed. We talk about transformation of these consciousnesses, but I think more accurately, it's more like they're just revealed, the true nature of the consciousness is revealed to be perfect wisdom. Transformation sounds like we're going to have to like put it in this like food processor and like turn it on full blast for like three countless eons to churn up this dualistic consciousness until it becomes perfect wisdom. That's the problem with saying transformation. But if you say it's like a revelation, then it can just be instant, right? Like you don't have to like transform the snake into a rope by like twisting it up and painting it white instead of green and like clamping its mouth shut and gradually transform the snake into a rope. It's more just like it's just revealed that the rope is actually not a snake. And the revelation is instant too, right? When you shine the flashlight, no, it's not a snake. I don't have to gradually, the mouth is not really a mouth, the tail is not really the tail, it's just the whole thing at once, instantly, doesn't actually become a rope, right? It's just revealed as.
Would this be a mistake to say this is similar, we're embedded in eternity, that our experience of time shuts it out, but it's there.
Yeah.
But we're in it at the same time, so if you remove that,
I think it's true. Time is an other dependent phenomena that arises from the storehouse consciousness, which is a weird way, but it's actually it's on some lists anyway of other dependent phenomena, time, and it's, in other words, it's a projection. And then we reify it, like we get little like watches and clocks, and we say like this is actually telling us actual time. But like you say, in a way, you could say we exist in eternity, but
it shuts us out the experience of the time. But if we're there.
Yeah, I mean, maybe we could say that one aspect of the thoroughly established nature that we're actually, you could say, in. Is that it's eternal, and it is eternity, and you could say, I would just maybe look at there might be some problem with saying that we exist in eternity. I mean, unless we say, because we are a projection too, right? So it's like, but you could say the illusion of me exists in this non-illusion of eternity. And me goes along with time and lifespan of a certain number of years. And that whole thing is an illusion. But you could say, like, from the illusory perspective, there's me that exists in time. Both of those are illusions. But there's, like, me walking through time. They're both illusions. From a more ultimate truth perspective, it's more like Buddha nature. It's not really a separate me, exists in eternity, and it never changes at all. And you could say, in a way, that's who our true nature is Buddha nature, and eternity is the true nature of time. So in the conventional truth, there's me in time, and in the ultimate truth, there's Buddha nature in eternity, which are both ungraspable and inconceivable. But you could say that's, right now, that is the case. That's the nice thing about conventional and ultimate truth. Again, are not like you have to transform the conventional truth into the ultimate truth. They're both always simultaneously the case. It's just that we virtually never appreciate or recognize the ultimate truth. We live in this conventional truth, or this what's so-called third truth, that's like not even a truth at all. Maybe that's where we really live, is this totally imagined, fabricated world of separate objects that you could say is not even really conventional truth. Another kind of experiential thing, I think. trying to distinguish between the other dependent appearances and the imagined real things. That's a kind of blurry line, and like, how do we describe that in our experience? My current understanding of this is like, I think we can actually get in touch with other dependent nature not so difficultly. Like, it's like if we're just really relaxed, basically, and we're just kind of like, and zazen, you know, I think this happens around zazen a lot. We're just like sitting and we're like really relaxed. We might even be like, I was kind of looking at around my room, trying to like tune into these two different modes, and it's kind of like, there are these appearances, right? Stuff's appearing, but we're really, we don't have to interact with it, we don't have to really grasp it. So it's almost like before we name it, we're like looking around and there's like, there's light and color coming in, but if we're just relaxed and not trying to define things with names, but we're actually seeing them, this may be like the other dependent appearances. They're just mind is creating these appearances, but they're not causing too much trouble. We're not like totally grasping and caught up in all these problems about them. But then very, very easily and quickly and almost without noticing the change, as soon as we like, you know, I'm just looking around and then somebody says like, where's the recorder? And I might even be looking at it before they say it. And then I go, oh, it's right here. Then it suddenly shifted from this appearance into this imagined actual recorder. It's a transition from the experience of just the other dependent appearance to an actually imagined thing through naming, as the sutra says. It has a lot to do with somebody says recorder, and the name gets fixated with the appearances or signs of the object, and then we have an actual thing. And then you can feel the relaxation level going down very slightly. That you can do this, you know, just with a word. You're just sitting, you're just like open to like all this, like, you know, sensory information is just like coming in, and it's just fine. And then somebody says, like, you know, light fixture. And like, I suddenly, like, I'm already looking at it, but then it's like I feel this, like, a little bit of shutting down, a little bit of grasping. It's very slight. Unless they say, like, look out, the light fixture's about to break. And then you're like, no! And then we really grasp it, right? And we're like, no, it's too expensive, we have to replace it. And then we're totally have a lot of problems. But even just to say light fixture, I can, the relaxation kind of like, things kind of narrow down, you know. I'm just relaxed with something happening here. Recorder. It's just like, can you get a sense of that? This is, I may be off here, but this is my current understanding of the kind of experiential difference between other dependent and imputational. And so mostly when we're dealing in the realm of concepts and conceptual thinking and all, we're just totally caught in imagined reality. We you know, I find like if I'm reading, if I'm on the computer for like hours, it's like I don't even notice that I'm in a room. It's like the appearing room is like basically gone, and I'm totally in imagined reality. And then you can just relax, stop thinking about all this stuff. You can kind of enter into that more relaxed space of other dependent reality. But then this third one of thoroughly established or perfect, that's the one that I think it's hard to just slip into in everyday life. But it might be like in maybe an experiential sense of it is in zazen, when we're really settled in zazen, really like shikantaza kind of zazen, where we're just really letting go of, basically we're working with we're working with all three. We're letting go of the gross conceptualizations of like, I can't stop thinking about what this person said to me. It's like, okay, relax that stuff. You know, that's the first level. We're getting more settled. Now it's just like there's thoughts arising and passing. It's like they're not so, we don't have such a grip on them, but they still are arising and passing. Those, like the, secretions of mind. And those are like other dependent. And then we just keep letting go, and then there may be a moment when actually there isn't any thought arising at all. And there's no appearances at all. Maybe just for a moment, and that may be like thoroughly established.
So, to bring in the other scheme we talked about last year, the sixth consciousness is like the aggregator of the other five consciousness, first five consciousness. It's analogous to saying, you're in the room while all these things are just coming up, but seventh consciousness is, unlike the sixth, is not an aggregator, it's a differentiator. That's where all the imputations come from. Mm-hmm. So when we relax the aggregate, the differentiator, maybe along the lines of what you were saying, we are approaching the sixth simply as an aggregator of what is arising. If we continue in that mode, and relaxing the aggregator even, we are in fact approaching eternity in a sense. So when we relax, the aggregator is actually a constraint on the ultimate. And things only show up when we constrain the ultimate. And if we relax the constrainer, we begin to approach the ultimate, but we can never actually get there.
That's a nice story. I like that. We're first working with the seventh consciousness that's creating this self and other strong dualistic split, and then we're kind of like, you could say the process of Zazen is relaxing that the workings of the seventh consciousness, settling into the sixth consciousness, just mental consciousness, which has both conceptual mode and even virtually non-conceptual modes too, and the sixth consciousness, but that's not, it's a consciousness, remember, it's not Buddha nature. So but in the realm of shamatha practice, or calm abiding, you could say that's basically just using the sixth consciousness and settling deeply into the sixth consciousness. And then the shift to so-called vipassana or insight would be like when the sixth consciousness starts to dissolve or be revealed as, again, this kind of non-dual wisdom, or we see like the Buddha nature that's like not even the slight sense of like slight sense of me meditating, which can get really slight. It can be like, it's not really, I'm not thinking, yeah, I'm meditating, but it can be, you can get so it's like almost unnoticeable, but there's still, maybe like you hear a little cough or something, and you have, and it reminds you of this little, of this sense of that there's me in a room with other people without even naming it. I think this complete non-duality is when there's not even the slightest sense of separation at all.
So the more immersed we are in the here and now, the less able we are to say here and now.
That's true, yeah. Completely immersed in the here and now. Like gold that's been refined, free from dross and impurities, the sky without a cloud. Immersed in the here and now. Imagined reality purified. The sky of mind without any clouds, even appearing clouds, not to mention reified clouds. So imagined reality purified means like it's the sky-like nature of mind has been purified of all imaginations. Imagined reality doesn't exist. The snake doesn't exist. Dependent reality does. So my commentary here would be, I would add in seem to. Because ultimately, dependent reality doesn't exist. To me this makes more sense. And this next two sections, if we say imagine reality doesn't exist, dependent reality does seem to exist, you could add in parentheses, perfect reality does exist. Assertions and denials by projections are undone. If imagined reality doesn't exist and dependent reality does seem to, if one doesn't and the other does seem to, from what doesn't comes what does seem to. If we don't put in the seem to, I don't know what to do with those verses myself. If you put in, I don't know what to say, like, about if, how does something that exists come from what doesn't exist? But something that seems to exist, like the watch seems to exist, we could say that in a way that comes from the imagined reality where there really is a watch. Now, we usually would say it the other way around, right? First you have the dependent appearance of a watch, and then with that appearance as a basis, you project a real watch onto it. But this is kind of playing with, maybe you could see it the other way around too, that from what doesn't exist, the imagined real watch that doesn't exist, from that comes what seems to exist. Maybe this would be a kind of experiential meditation description here. From this really existing watch that doesn't really exist, you know, this what seems to really exist but doesn't here, that's what we start with. And then from that gross imagination, through meditation, can come a merely appearing watch that actually appears to exist.
You say that form is pure imagination. An imputed form is dependent reality.
Well, usually we would say, like, the dependently arising appearance of form is other dependent, and then, like, a truly existent real form would be imagined. You know, it doesn't exist at all. I mean, it's kind of this funny thing. When we imagine something to really exist, that's what doesn't exist at all, right? That's what we're talking about. And then this other dependent is like kind of in between. It's like it kind of appears to exist, and it kind of exists, conventionally speaking. And then it's the kind of middle, it's this middle ground of conventional truth. It appears, and it seems to exist. And then this thing that when we solidify it, it really doesn't exist at all as an actual, solid, separate watch. But that's what actually seems to truly, solidly exist.
Well, for example, mathematics is pure form. So it becomes a Higgs boson when that mathematics is imputed upon what activity is happening at the single black. So at that point, that which doesn't exist, that which exists, the Higgs boson, independently arises out of that which does not exist, which is just the mathematics.
Maybe we could do something there, like with that. But let's go on for now. Thus is dependent reality based upon projection.
So, based upon sounds like it comes after.
I would equate them, yeah. So based upon, yeah, a lot of this language is moving around here. You could say based upon, based in, creating, projection, all they're interdependent. How about that? Dependent reality is interdependent with projection. We could say it's the same thing. Or we could also say projection is one aspect of it. It's not the whole story, but projection is... Yeah, I think, you know, if I was writing the sutra, I would say projection is based on dependent reality. I think that's what you're saying too, right? From which name and appearance follow, giving rise to more projections. And again, we were saying that name and appearance are also both, I would propose, aspects of dependent reality. But they're the building blocks. Name, appearance, and projection are all just appearing, other dependent appearances. But they're those three are these essential building blocks for the imaginary nature, especially name and appearance. As soon as you have the name gets connected to the appearance, it that's what creates the so-called imagined nature. Remember that part? Or fixation on name and appearance. Though they remain unperfected, once you get past all projections, knowledge is thus purified. This is ultimate truth. Can you follow that? All projections, names, and appearances are not the perfect nature, right? They're just appearances. But once you get past all these projections, knowledge, or prajna, is purified, and this is ultimate truth. Projections are 12 in number, and this list comes from the previous section in the sutra on page 157. So I just, and there, each one has a paragraph describing it, so I just put in the list here. These are different types of other dependent projections, words, object of words, characteristics, values, self-existence, causes, views, reasoning, arising, non-arising, continuity, bondage, and emancipation. So, and you could say there's infinite projections that just happen to list 12 here. And it's a nice section of the sutra to go back and read those and see the definitions of all of them and see how they are, see them from the point of view of the other dependent nature. So projections are 12 in number. Dependent reality is sixfold. But remember that those are projections are part of dependent reality. So you could say these are just two different models. You could say there's 12 types of projections. But that's another way to look at that is the sixfold dependent reality, which there's no one knows for sure what that refers to. But Red Pine's take is the six consciousnesses, and I like that story, rather than some weird lists that he also listed some commentators put forth. The simplest one is just saying the six consciousnesses, or the six scent objects, you know, color, sound, smells, taste, touches, and mental objects, that's dependent reality. That's the other dependent. That's those appearances, the appearances of the world, from which we build a real world, a reified world, an external world through the imagined nature. So dependent reality is sixfold. The knowledge known to oneself includes not one distinction. This just means the perfect nature, ultimate truth. There's no distinctions. Truth includes five dharmas. Reality has three modes. The five dharmas is this next section. The realities, three modes of what we've been talking about. Practitioners or yogis who distinguish these don't separate from suchness. So the job of yogis to not separate from suchness is to basically distinguish these three natures, or five dharmas, it's the same thing. Isn't that interesting? It's not like yogis have to achieve the thoroughly established perfect nature and destroy the other two? No, they just have to distinguish the three. Just like you don't have to destroy the snake to and the rope to see the truth. You just have to distinguish. There's rope, there's the appearance of a snake when I see it in the dark, not so clearly, and then there's the non-appearance of the snake, the no snake. So it's such a relief to not find the snake. The seat of observation, or the result of the observation. Dependent reality and appearances, imagined reality and names, from the characteristics of projection, dependent reality arises. So you could say they're just listing different, all these different building blocks we've been talking about. It's just a list. I would say it's a little funny the way the list is set up, but without spending a lot of time on it, let's just see all these things we've been talking about. Dependent reality, appearances, imagined reality, names. It's not like we're necessarily equating those things or anything. But from the characteristics of projection, dependent reality arises. Now, D.T. Suzuki's translation, I think, is all the, this one case where I appreciate his even more. His of this verse says, in dependent reality, something like, I'm using these translations of terms, but his structure says, in dependent reality, there are names which are projections. Various projections arise from dependent reality. That's more straightforward to me. I'll read again. In dependent reality, there are names which are projections. Various projections arise from dependent reality and as part of dependent reality. So names, projections, appearances are all aspects of dependent reality, but when they're grasped or seen as fused together, they become the imagined. In the radiant light of wisdom, so now we're talking about Buddha nature, the Dharmakaya, suchness, like the Sanskrit term here is buddhi, like related to Buddha. In the radiant light of wisdom, dependent and imagined reality vanish, nor does perfected reality exist, so how is anything distinguished? Now here we say, usually it's said that perfected reality does exist. That's the ultimate truth. It does exist, not as a thing. So here again, D.T. Suzuki's translation says, in the radiant light of wisdom, something like, dependent and reality vanish. In perfect reality, nothing exists. How is anything distinguished? So instead of, nor does perfected reality exist, this says, in perfect reality, no thing exists. I think that's more clear and more helpful teaching. In perfect reality, nothing exists, but you could say in parentheses, except the perfect reality, which is not a thing. Because their natures are distinguished, the two realities are established. Where a myriad projections appear, lies the realm of pure Buddha knowledge. Now that's also a kind of weird statement that Red Pine maybe added in as a kind of like non-dual Zen type of teaching, but unusual. I thought in the sutra, where a myriad projections appear, lies the realm of pure Buddha knowledge. So you could say, you know, where the projections appear, truly that deluded appearance is truly Buddha. That's kind of a Zen-like teaching, but it doesn't fit in so well with the rest of the sutra that's trying to be more, a little bit more straightforward. So D.T. Suzuki says, where a myriad projections appear, when purified, is the realm of Buddha knowledge. That's a little more like in accord with the sutra. So it's not that where the myriad projections appear, that is the pure Buddha knowledge. It's more like where the myriad projections appear, purified is Buddha knowledge. You can see how from the Sanskrit you could translate it in these different ways. When purified is the realm of Buddha knowledge. Imagined reality is like a painting projecting dependent reality. Or I think we could say, imagined reality is like a painting projected by dependent reality. Might be more clear. But a painting is a nice metaphor for imagined reality. Dogen talks about the painting of a rice cake. How painting of a rice cake doesn't satisfy hunger because it's just purely imagination. It means conceptual teachings aren't going to satisfy you. Is that a reasonable idea of painted rice cake don't satisfy hunger?
Except for the hunger for conceptual teachings.
Well, then Dogen turns it, right? He usually takes these old classic Buddhist sayings and says, actually, painted rice cakes do satisfy hunger. And they satisfy painted hunger. And hunger is always painted and rice cakes are always painted. And I think what he's pointing to is just you can read that whole essay in terms of the three natures in quite a wonderful way. I think he's saying that when we see that everything is just projected, then we can just go ahead and eat. Or go ahead, and we can study sutras like this. This is like painted rice cakes, right? You can say, ah, these words are never going to help us. We have to directly experience. But if you see that everything we can, even putting aside sutras, that's another painted rice cake, right? So everything is, we live in this world of projection. But if we, again, yogis distinguish the three, if we say, it's just a bunch of illusion, but let's eat it. Or let's read it. Let's play with it. Let's enjoy it because it's okay. It's just words, but it satisfies a certain kind of hunger.
Because
it's actually, its nature is that, it's not really, if we're trying to grasp the words of the sutra to get them and be free from all our problems, then we're caught by that, then we're actually reifying it. But if we see, oh no, they are just, it's just imagination, but the imagination is based on appearances, and that whole thing is free from the imagination and the appearances, then we can go ahead. In fact, we have to go ahead and keep living this life. And the interesting thing about this sutra is it's talking about the very thing here, right? It's like, remember in other discussions about this, the Buddha gets into like the problem of words and fingers pointing at the moon and all these things in the sutra about words and language being such a problem, but he's saying it all in words and language. So it's kind of like the joke behind it, you know, that it's okay. In the realm of painted hunger, painted rice cakes can satisfy, but imagine reality is like a painting projected by dependent reality, and maybe also projecting dependent reality. Something other than projection, this is the view of other schools. In other words, what this, you know, the next verse, what is projected by projection, they see coming from causes, those of other schools. Beyond the duality of projection, this is where perfection occurs. So I thought this might even be referring to a maybe kind of basic Madhyamaka view, where we say everything is depending on causes and conditions. We say this world, this zendo, depends on causes and conditions, and that's how it comes to be. Whereas in this teaching, the Buddha is saying those people from another school who might even say that, they think it's something other than just projection. They think the zendo is arising maybe from like the parts. The zendo arises from the wood and the walls and the ceiling, instead of just merely from the projection of the storehouse consciousness. It's maybe a different, even within Buddhist schools, that this sutra is saying it's just arising from projections. Now, I don't want to, I think that actually, truly, Madhyamaka school is completely, which is the middle way teachings of Nagarjuna, for example, is totally in accord with this mind only. And you could say the reason why is, in this case, if we say the zendo is arising from the walls and the platforms and the ceiling and the altar all put together, and that's what it's dependent on those parts, the zendo arises. I would say it arises on these causes or conditions of its parts. But you could say, well, how does it actually arise from those parts? By a projection. It's still the same thing, really, from this Madhyamaka, which is a cause and condition too, yeah. A projection is a condition thing too. But you could say, you have the walls and the ceiling and the floor and all these pieces of the zendo, but you need one last ingredient to make it a zendo. You need to project this zendo-ness out of these parts. You can't just You can't just line up the floor with the ceiling just so. You need the last ingredient, right, of the projection of Zendo with the word. So I don't know if you could follow that, but that's a way where these middle way teachings about dependent co-arising are very much in accord with mind only. This mind only is really emphasizing the projecting. It's not even saying, it's not even talking about walls and ceilings and parts. It's talking about, it's just focusing on this one really important thing of how we project a world with this mind. So I was hoping we'd get through the next section, but oh well. Maybe you can read ahead this next section on the five dharmas, which is a lot of repeat of what we've been already going over. Five dharmas is just another version of the three natures.
What's
the section number? It is LXXXIII. Page 245. And also the next section, it's part of that section, and also LXXXIV. And then we can maybe just kind of zip through next time, because we have two more classes, and these other two pages are where we are really shifting to a whole new vision of Tathagata Garbha, the heart of the Buddha, the womb of the Buddha, Buddha nature, which we haven't, we've been touching on, but it's a new thing. So, and these, by the way, if you feel like we're going too fast and you want to, like, you don't catch all of it, we're posting these talks on the web. You can go back and listen. I feel torn in these classes between slowing way down and going into more questions to unpack this stuff, and plunging ahead through these four pages. I welcome your feedback too if you feel like this is going way too fast, or if it feels like it's going way too slow, and let's get on with it. Please let me know. May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become Buddha.